These are some poems that I wrote as a result of a bicentennial tour took around the country 2 years ago. And the genesis of the idea of this book was to visit some of the nation's monuments, battlefields, one thing or another, and try to capture, if possible, some of the feeling of America, and publish the book. Well, when I got back, I realized two things. Number one, I have no poems about monuments. I somehow missed, I saw them all, but I don't have any poems on the Washington Monument or the Capitol or the rock where the pilgrims stepped on, because for one reason, as you know, it's enclosed in that horrible little thing, Neo-Greek mess. So I missed all that for some reason. My poems are rather about little streams or a little diner in upstate New York on Highway 20, or South Shaftesbury, Vermont, the Bennington area. But they still captured for me some flavor of America, and particularly the 13 colonies. Second thing that I noticed after someone pointed out to me is that they're almost all of them have water in them. There are 27 poems in the book, and almost all of them have water. And that's because it rained the whole time. It just rained, rained, rained. And we were camping in a little Montgomery Ward tent camper that opened up, and the thing leaked constantly, so it was a miserable 30 days, 9,000 miles. But the nights were miserable, the days were okay. We saw a lot. So I think I'll start by, I started writing the poems in the Kansas, Nebraska area. And here's a little poem called Along the Platte. The moon rises over the river, etching the trees against the sky, sifting on the shallow water to the sandhill cranes, standing with small moons in their eyes. These poems, the other night I read poems from Plum Creek Odyssey, which are narrative poems. They tell stories about people in the Midwest, about farms, about auctions. And if there's time tonight, I'll maybe read one or two of those, but I'm going to read those again Monday night. But tonight I thought I'd do these. These are different kinds of poems. These are not story poems. These are almost vignettes. They're little tone poems that set a stage, paint a brief outline of a picture, and then leave it and let you fill in the details if you want to. Went to my uncle's farm in southern Illinois where I was born in a big front room. I thought all babies are born in front rooms. Had a big old front room which was only open in case somebody died who was going to be born. And I remember as I grew up it had a white porcelain doorknob on it. And I used to love to, when my granny wasn't looking, go over and lick that doorknob. She used to say, "You're weird, Jack. You got to quit doing this." Then Bill and I would go out and pretend we were cows and lick the salt licks. Yeah. Right? For those of you who haven't kicked that habit, there's one behind Chalet 1. And sometimes on the way to 10 miles, nobody's looking, I take a quick hit off of that. And then another thing our farm had on it was, I've since learned that people who are really gentleman farmers and come from good areas don't have, is hog wallers, we call them, where all the hogs just got in there and wallered around. And it was just muddy, it was only maybe a foot or two deep. So after licking the salt, Bill and I would go skinny dipping in the hog waller. And the hogs didn't mind, so it was all right. And then my aunt would come at this with a switch, and then another day would end. But anyway, we stopped at this farm. And this is called, it's Greenville, Illinois, about 50 miles from St. Louis, I guess. It's called Greenville Dusk. It's about kittens, in a way, because there were some wild little kittens. Some cat had just come in off the road and had kittens in a bush. The kittens hid themselves beneath the flowers, and only the white one hissed and spat at my hand. The sun was down in the dark woods, and James fished quietly and alone at the pond. Inside, the air conditioner still hummed, and laughter and baking, sizzling of meat and cracking of nuts. The dogs barked at me as I watched the cats. The mother watched the dogs through narrow slits of eyes. The cold earth mists were rising from the pond, and James blurred with the old tree stumps and bales of straw put there to soak up algae. The fields rose and fell in the shimmering cold. The sky reached the tops of trees and covered them. My son moved in shadow toward the barn, his pole catching some last ray of light, his feet making no sound on the wet grass, and the eyes of the kittens shone like agates in a stream. This is north of Greenville. After Greenville, we started up towards Wheaton, where my brother lives, not too far from Chicago. Ground fogs lingered on the damp fields and rose in sheets before the gauzy sun that hung above the lines of trees. The highway curved through Litchfield, Hillsboro, Greenville, and wound among old barns where the old men sat with pipes on cane chairs in front of feed stores. The midday heat had not come. It was that quiet time when mists rose and fell in diaphanous folds on mossy trees and over stubbled fields, and the greening earth was quiet and still, save for the blackbirds in the bottom along Mill Creek. Some of the states that we visited, we were in an awful lot of them, didn't get a poem, but all the 13 colonies did. In fact, I found myself roaring through the East Coast, and I'd forgotten Delaware, so I had to backtrack about 100 miles and went through about 2.5 miles of Delaware. But I got the poem. I felt duty bound to do that, and so I got it. This is 34 between Seward and Lincoln. Between Seward, Nebraska, Lincoln's about 25 miles apart, and there's a little dirt, a hard road called Highway 34. And I went to school at the University of Nebraska, and lived back there for a while. And used to drive, live in Seward, and I'd drive and I'd see all these the farmers and the farms and in the winter and spring and summer and plowing and planting. And I used to wonder about the people and who they were, but I never stopped and pulled in and got out and said, "Hello, I'm Jack Ledbetter. Who are you and why are you doing what you do?" That'd be a silly thing to do. So I just kept driving, but I always wondered who they were. So it led to the poem, 34, between Seward and Lincoln. The mice grow fat in the warm straw inside the rotting timbers of the barn. Outside on Highway 34, the cars drill past the old barns to Seward or Lincoln. And no one knows just why the old woman wears the man's hat and goes with the plow each morning. In the winter, the calves are called from the frozen ravine, and the road curves dangerously to the right, and lights come on inside the house. There is no way to talk. There is no way to know anything about them. There is no way to live with them. And they will be there in the spring, the man's hat on her head, their boots filling with mud, the calves kicking across the ravine, where the flowers will push through the ice and brambles, searching for sun. As we go along on this journey, if you have any comments you want to make or ask questions or say anything, hope you'll feel free to do that. Because it won't bother me in the least, may lead to another poem that I've forgotten. Mm-hmm. So if you want to ask anything or say anything, just have at it. If I don't like your question, I'll just ignore it. This is called Waiting for the Fourth. The 4th of July, coming up Tuesday, is a time when all a lot of people get together, and it was no different when I was a kid on the farm. And this poem, even though I wrote it 2 years ago, is about when I was a kid on the farm and all the Ledbetters and everybody else related would get together. Waiting for the Fourth. When it was dark enough, we got out the sparklers and lit them and did cartwheels in the air. Uncle Frank lit his pipe and we all wanted to have a puff of it. Aunt Letha told us to get down off of him and act right or the sparklers would be over. Bill cussed and his mother said not to, and I tried it, but no one heard me. So we threw the sparklers in the air and one landed on the roof of the chicken house, and my dad ran to the well for water, and Letha came after us, and Frank put out his pipe, and it was over again. Those memories of the family getting together are kind of wild memories, and I think Monday night when I'm going to read poems from Plum Creek Odyssey, about which are story poems, I'm going to talk a little bit about Christmas. And Christmas was a rare time when I was growing up because we were all scared to death. Because my relatives had a kind of a warped idea of what made kids good. I thought it was warped. Their idea was to keep them scared. So Christmas for me was the most frightening time of the year because they kept telling me Claus is coming. And I said, Claus is coming? They met Santa Claus. They called him Claus. I'll tell you about Claus, but not soon. It'll scare me if I talk about it tonight. Well, we went across upstate New York, Highway 20, I think it was, and stopped at a little place called Connor's Diner. Stillwater, New York. Beautiful little place. Still raining. Went in there for breakfast. The rain chased us into Connor's Diner for breakfast. The counter turned as one man to look at us, dripping in the doorway. Charlie, when are you coming to fix the downspout? Charlie laughed from the counter and stirred his hot coffee. The windows fogged and the rain seemed a billion miles away from us. And the counter people hunched over their eggs and home fries and talked in early morning grunts and shuffled morning papers. The doc sat across from us and smoked cigarettes and joked with Charlie. His wife smoked and stared at her husband and said nothing. Outside, the rain beat on the green hillsides, running off cellar doors and washed against outbuildings. The hills rose and fell in a gauzy dream where apple orchards soaked and dripped in the warm rain.
How about Rhode Island, Jack?
Rhode Island. All right. Let's see. I don't have one called Rhode Island, but is Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island?
Yeah. Yes.
All right. His geography is about maybe fouled up here. So I've got one called Narragansett Bay.
Very good.
Okay. I'll read that for Art and Maury. Right. The early morning breeze flutters the small sails beneath the bridge. Violets bloom along the western shore. And a sailor goes out to sea, where great billows rock above hidden shoals. Far offshore, buoys bob in sheets of fog, sentinels crested in foam, rising and falling in giant troughs. The sea slides and rises, pounding against itself in wind and rain that slashes the tops of waves, tunneling, spiring, chuffing in angry swirls and mountains that fall with thunderous slaps against the ships. And the day wears away and the winds die, and the waves sway into easy motion with the white spume flying, the sky breaking blue and clear, sun patches glinting, stepping across the water. And home to the old houses rising above the trees, the rolling land down to the sea, this narrow green land, where the Atlantic rolls its heavy way against the seawall. And moth-like sails glide, their brass catching the setting sun, pulling their shadows over the amber water. And lights blink on along the eastern shore, the bridge stark against the sky. In darkness, the tide rises soundlessly. Small boats rise and bump at anchor, their lines creaking. The sea full and heavy beneath the moon. And the gulls rest atop pilings or bob in silvery shadows. And the sailor is home. Thank you. Maybe one way to do this voyage would be to, if you have any, you want to sing out for a state rather than just go the route that we went. I'll just do them in disorder.
We lived in New Jersey for 5 years. What do you do? What does a poet do with New Jersey? One poetic place.
Well, I'm glad you asked that.
Okay. So
I wasn't going to read that poem. When I grew up, I read dog books by a man named Albert Passenger Hume. And the dog, a lad, son of lad, his cousin and all the, you know, Treve and Wolf and Bruce. I just loved them, and they were from a place called Pompton Lakes, New Jersey. So I thought, if I ever get to the East Coast, I am going to find that place. Well, we were coming down Manhattan with the car, kids screaming, legs falling out the windows, a little rack on top, and the Montgomery Ward thing bumping on its two little tires back. We went down, saw the Statue of Liberty, and headed back up, and then I was going to try to find New Jersey. I don't know where New Jersey is. I'm driving along, and first, before I know it, three policemen, and on a freeway, mind you, they come running out in front of me and say, stop, you can't take this two-wheel thing on this freeway, you got to be on this freeway. So they stop traffic on a six-lane interstate, turned us around, everybody honking and going, and get us back on the right freeway. So finally, we're going the right, this has something to do with New Jersey, we're going the right direction, and I look at my watch, and it's 4:30, 4:45. I said, I've got to get off. I know New Jersey is west of us, I think. And I don't know where to get off of the freeway. And I said, well, I'll try this. So I turned off and came to a complete stop because there we were on Broadway and 42nd Street or something like that, and the traffic and the taxi cabs were ankle deep all over the place. We finally made it to New Jersey. But the section I saw in New Jersey as I went down the coast, this was not Pompton Lakes.
No, that's west. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I saw a lot of factories and... but I'll read you the poem if you want to hear that.
Sure.
Okay, New Jersey.
Is that the title, New Jersey?
New Jersey, yeah.
Can't think of anything else?
No, I just thought I'd give it the state. All along the river, the tall grass grew in still water. The birds nested in reeds and jumped in outrage and noise. The smoke from factories hung over the marsh, and the tall grass smoldered in a green ruin. The water was choked and dirty along the road. Hills beyond the town rose dark green and distant. The clouds were gathering again, and the rain would come soon. The water was still, and then a wind rippled the surface, driving birds into the air. Then the rain, hard with a flash of lightning, and the tall grass bent in the wind, swirled and tossed against the water, and the smoke was beat down against the gray factories until they were lost, and the distant mountains were lost, and only the tall grasses hissed and hissed.
How about Connecticut?
Yay.
Okay.
Why
isn't
there
a
new Massachusetts?
This is like a Beanie sing with, what's your favorite name? 252. All right. This is Cornwall Hollow. Those of you know where that is, the northwestern part of Connecticut. And there's little towns called Cornwall, Cornwall Hollow, North Cornwall, East Cornwall, South Cornwall. A beautiful little covered bridge near there. And a favorite poet of mine has a farm there. A fellow named Mark Van Doren has 150 acres of beautiful woods. And we spent some time there. And down in Cornwall runs the Housatonic Valley, the Housatonic River. And on each side of the river, undergrowth as far as you could see, impenetrable trees, an old cemetery up on the hill. Absolutely gorgeous. This looked like Eden. I've never seen such beauty as in Cornwall part of Connecticut. This is Housatonic Valley, Connecticut. The Housatonic rolls south through Cornwall, Falls Village, Canaan. The trees spread across the leaping water, spearing the air, green clouds over the water. From the cemetery on the hill, green mounds rose in waves breaking against the old fence, the air heavy, quiet. And the carving river found new ledges, invaded soft furrows of forgotten times, and made trees into islands, uncovered echoes long hidden among roots and mossy rocks. Sounds of horses, shouts, and whirring of wings above the ancient river, all mingled with names, dates, fingers reaching goodbyes, all mixed with the rushing river moving south beneath cool branches dipping to the water. Did you ask for Massachusetts? Okay. The one I've got on Massachusetts is called Seaman's Bethel, New Bedford, Massachusetts, which was really a neat place. And having been to Walden and doing the Freedom Trail in Boston and all that, then to come across New Bedford, which was quiet, and it's where a lot of the whaling ships put out. It's where Melville wrote part of Moby Dick. And in fact, we saw the big whaling museum there in New Bedford, and right across the road from the whaling museum was the Seaman's Bethel, this little white church. And there were just no more than maybe 20 pews in the church. And there on one of them was a little brass plaque that said Herman Melville's pew. So that was kind of neat to see that. That's a Seaman's Bethel. The rows of clean, hard benches were silent, starched white, their secrets fingered in memory along the smooth backs. The plaques reflected names of men and boats and great whales who swam deep seas and spouted great sprays covering Nantucket Island. The rope ladder led among forgotten shrouds and lines and dreams of Leviticus thundering like waves on the bitter shoals. This pulpit, this crow's nest high in the rigging where cobwebs balanced in the amber light that warmed the room. And the night came on, covering the bright names, canceling the deeds of errantry, still the bleating of sea elephants and raucous cry of gulls who circled the foaming, angry sea before Leviathan broke, where the great whales rolled and men pointed the slender boats among white furrows and dreamed of lights at shore and yearned for the voice of the iron bell of chapel rolling heavily seaward. Okay, I've got one called Carolinas. I thought I'd put them both together, lump them together. It rained there too. Oh, did it rain? I don't think I've ever seen such hard rain as in the Carolinas. It rained until we got to Atlanta. I thought I'd go to Atlanta and then turn right and try to find Los Angeles after that. And it rained in Atlanta, but once we started west from Atlanta, it stopped raining. And we ran into the kudzu. You know about kudzu, those in the south? Anybody from Alabama, Mississippi? You've probably seen it. It's a vine that grows and covers everything. It'll cover you if you stand still. Covers whole trees. Nothing. You see nothing but the green outline. It covers old cars and out in the fields and old houses. We saw houses with the vines breaking the windows and curling around. They brought it over from France, I think, about 100 years ago. Maybe not that long, 50 years ago, to fill in ravines. And it just did so well. It just took over ravines, fields, farmhouses. Now they can't get rid of it. It grows 50 feet in a season, in the summertime. So there's no good cutting it down. And once it starts, it's goodbye fields. All right, this is Carolinas. We pulled into a camp. We were camping, as I said, and we pulled into this campgrounds. And a lot of stuff was going on, so it led to this one, Carolinas. The Carolinas spread out in rolling clouds of green beneath a heavy sky. The dirt ran red in streams and sloshed against us as we walked. The couple next to us held a baby and glanced at us only once. Two men walked heavily down the path to the store, and one cursed the rain and spat. Their wives, heavy in cotton dresses, followed, kids straggling behind like leaves scattered in sudden gusts. The camp office, beneath the blue light that hummed, scorching, burning flying bugs. Boys jumped in pools, girls played a jukebox and leaned against the wall with solemn, dark, frightened eyes. Sounds rising down every road, cars breaking, fish frying, and children trying flashlights down darkening paths. A thin woman sat alone at a picnic table, her dinner boiling on a camp stove, she not looking at it. Across the way, a party with loud country music and dogs chained to trees, gnawing bones beneath the house trailer. The soft sounds, slow sounds, the velvet speech, the quick glances at our license plates, the silent men, the thin, wasted women looking out from trucks, babies nursing, others asleep under quilts and comforts in the bed of the pickup. Boys fishing at the dark pond, their lines appearing and disappearing in the setting sun. The hoots and hollers from the horseshoe pits where the man in bib overalls dances in his pit while the tall, thin man all in black chews thoughtfully as others race to measure the shoes. Along the highway, trucks boil along the steaming road, their headlights lighting up a face coming down the path, the eyes rolling, showing the whites of the eyes. The banjo tinkling softly across the pond, their fire throwing sparks, licking shadows up the tree trunks, and the camp quieting, the stars blinking on in the dark sky. And one by one, the fires go out, and the dogs move easy on their tethers. A baby cries once in a gentle hush beneath the swelling and rising moon. Carolinas was nice. I mean, they were all nice, but that particularly, a lot of things.
How about Wisconsin?
No, I didn't get up to Wisconsin. Sorry. I'll make one up later. No, I knew I shouldn't have thrown this up for Dad. I should have told you the itinerary before we started. We went from Illinois up into Michigan and up to Canada and over the Canadian side of the falls and into New York and then up to New England, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, then straight down. Pardon? I didn't get one on Michigan. We only had a short. Well, I was in Detroit, frankly, and I got lost a lot, three times. And I was really happy to get out of Detroit. And I just. Yeah, in Vermont. Yeah, I have one. I have one in Vermont. Yeah. We I was trying to see all of Robert Frost's poems. I've always been a fan of Robert Frost, and I teach his poetry at CLC every semester. So I wanted to look up his poems, and we found the one in South Shaftesbury, but it took a while. In fact, I was kind of glad that it wasn't a great big monument like that Parthenon built around Plymouth Rock. I couldn't find the one in South Shaftesbury, and I stopped at a couple of stores and went in a little grocery store, and a guy in an apron, like a waitry, and I said, "Can you tell me where Robert Frost's farm is?" And he says, "Who?" I said, "Robert Frost." And he scratched his head. He says, "No, I don't know of anybody." I said, "Well, he's dead." He said, "Well, then what do you want his farm for?" I said, "I just want to see it." So he called to the back to see if the guy from the butcher's apron came out with blood in hands. And he says, "What do you want to see?" We went through the same thing. And then he called out his wife, who was wrapping something in the back. And between all of us, we figured out what I wanted. So I found it. Beautiful little farm, about 100-yard lane back into his farm, a little red barn, a little stream coming over, a little pool. Gorgeous. Anyway, this poem is called Turkey Bell. It has nothing to do with Robert Frost. I don't know why I even said all that in South Shaftesbury. Because on the way, well, that's the way poems come, right? When you least expect it. It's like kind of a psychic itch you can't quite scratch, and something has to come of it. We were going up north through Vermont toward Bennington or from Bennington or wherever in that area, and there was this barn on the right with some pots and things and antiques out in front, and a bunch of geese, I remember, turkeys, and I pulled it off the road, and it led to this poem because it was a rather interesting fellow in there that I didn't quite understand. Turkey Bell. The hills were misty white, and the road curved past the old barn where two large turkeys scratched and bobbed among tall weeds. He moved in darkness deep inside the barn, among shadows of harness, crocks, glass, things that gave off no reflection in the gloom. Cars tore through the curve and honked at the turkey. Someone threw a can at them. The old man looked at me and mixed a sulfur compound on a dirty piece of glass. The hills behind his barn brought rain and moved towards the barn with murmur of thunder. Boards creaked beneath my feet, and smells lingered on my clothes, and hands and old sheet music rose in stacks. A plow had been left stuck in the side of the barn. Crockery bearing the word Bennington was paraded in front so cars could see. The rain broke above our heads, and the old man watched me, not speaking. He took his mixture and rubbed it in his brown hands, then sniffed it. I touched a large grindstone and watched the rain behind the barn hit the small pond, beating it into froth, and the turkeys cried and rushed beneath the barn. Cars swooshed water as they took the curve. The barn grew darker, and he lit an old kerosene lamp, and his face appeared and disappeared in shadow, his body shadow climbing the wall, mingling with the harness. He took a small brass bell from a glass cabinet and handed it to me. The turkeys gobbled from beneath the barn. The bell curved into my hand. Its tone was clear and heavy. A turkey bell, he called it. Our car glistened in the gathering dark as we backed down the gravel drive. The barn was dark, and the rain beat against the car, and we were gone. It's odd, isn't it, how those kinds of memories will linger on. Sometimes their poems will come from them, and sometimes there are no poems at all about them. And I'm never sure just how to press that button that's called poem. I lived in Southern California for years, and I have just maybe a handful of Southern California poems. I was a scuba diver for years and years all over the Southern California coast and Catalina Island, San Diego, and no poems about scuba diving with sharks and almost drowning in seaweed and seeing whales on the way to the nurseries down in Baja. No poems about those. But just driving with my little Datsun with kids' feet sticking out and a bumpy thing, and all of a sudden there's a poem about some of this and about a turkey bell. An insignificant turkey bell. And yet it took on tremendous significance somehow. I don't know why that is, but why do we need to know why? Any other states? You got a favorite state?
Maine.
Okay. Oh boy, did it rain in Maine. Who said
that? Maine in Maine.
Yes. On the plane, mostly, that's right.
Mainly.
Oh, man. Maine was beautiful, though, obviously. It was Maine summer. Up from the lazy, heavy sea that foams around the summer grasses stands the wood. Covered thick among the leaves and needles, fragrant with spruce and balsam, beneath the branches, the ground cover of blueberry floats leaf to leaf like some fairy sea, rocking gently on the slanting summer breezes rising off the warm ocean. And in the mystic movement of these two seas, green and alive, comes the call one to the other. This sea at the rocks, this sea of green beneath the trees, this Maine.
What do you have on Virginia?
No, I don't have one on Virginia. Oh, I wish I did. Doggone it, I'm going to have to go back. Yes, I do, too. My geography's fouled up again. I've got reading. Jamestown's not in Brooklyn, is it?
North Dakota.
Yeah. It was close. How about Jamestown? You do? Okay. I really enjoyed Jamestown, too. We went to Williamsburg, of course, it was fascinating and watching all the people with the crafts and doing all that. But there were so many people, and all that you had to pay $3 to get in every to watch somebody pound nails or sand into a rat hole or whatever they were doing. And so I just kind of walked around, didn't pay for anything. But then in Jamestown, didn't cost anything, and there was nobody, hardly anybody there. There was only one little store that sold some pots if you wanted them, and it was very uncommercial, right? Just bare ruins of Jamestown, and hot as blazes, and the sweat, and the mosquitoes, and that led to the poem, Jamestown. Jamestown poured its greenness into the ocean and sucked some narrow piece, some bone-bare strip of land, and said, here was home. Soundless, the green moving forest pressed close to open fires, eyes in dark woods blinked at falling trees, and birds circled, mixing cries with sorrow, rising and falling, anguish sinking into the sweating ground, becoming wind echoes or wave sounds as sand grated on rocks along the shores. And mosquitoes hovered like clouds above the still water, and festered in dark plants, their constant zinging bus sharpening death, or the long creepers flowering on logs, a moving green sea in a wet green world, holding footsteps in place, footfalls pressed in album leaves, garlanding this people caught in this narrow strip of burned land, whose shape, pressured by heat and snapped by cold, gives up few memories, but holds all things close to the sweating earth and whispers along curling tendrils toward the sun.
Tell us, Jack, when did you write the poems? Did you write them on your trip? Did you stop in your little Datsun and write something, make notes, or what did you do?
No, I wrote them the following January. We are on a 4-1-4 system, and January is interim. And I wasn't going to teach that January, so I knew it was either now or never, so I wrote them that month, the month of January. Sometimes as many as three or four would come in one day, otherwise one a day. And there were 27 in the collection. I rarely ever keep notes, which is kind of too bad. When I teach creative writing at CLC, and I encourage the students to keep some kind of a notebook and take notes and jot down things, and I'm too lazy to do that, or I've learned too late to do it. But anyway, I don't do it. Mm-hmm. I'll see something interesting, and I'll say, write that down, and then I'll forget it. But I'm not suggesting this works for every poet, but for me, just doing it, I just live and do things, and then later on, as Wordsworth said, you know, emotion recollected in tranquility. It may take years. I spent a couple of exciting weeks in Hong Kong a couple of years ago, and the most excitement I've had packed in 2 weeks and ever, and no poems yet. It's just, and that's been 2 years ago, but I know they're there. It's just going to take a long time. On our European trip last summer, I had 2 poems out of almost 7 weeks. There are enough poems there probably to last a lifetime, but they take their own sweet time. And they won't be hurried. We had a faculty staff meeting yesterday, and Henry was talking about his home, right, in southwest Virginia. And he was just talking about his home and the hills and things. And it was the most eloquent thing I've ever heard. And I was conscious that I was hearing poetry. He didn't mean it as poetry, but it was that way to me. And then he said a line. He was talking about change and how things don't ever remain the same. He says, the mountain's still there, but the days are gone. And boy, when he said that just bored right through my head. A hair rose on the back of my neck. The mountain's still there, but the days are gone. Now, that would be a poem. In fact, I hunted him down in Wes's emporium down there and asked him if I could borrow that line sometime for a poem, because I know it's coming. He said, sure. But that's where poems come from, and they come at their own time, usually, later.
You must have a remarkable memory.
Well, I really don't. And if my students heard that, they'd find that really hilarious. Because I have a hard time remembering anybody's names. I can remember people. But in fact, a year or so ago, I was down in the student body office waiting for somebody, the student body president or something, and I was sitting there, and the student body, one of the girls, was typing in a typewriter, and I picked up a magazine, looking at it, and I looked and smiled. She smiled, kept typing. I smiled again. I said, you've been here at CLC long? She says, 3 years. I said, well, that's nice. I said, what's your major? She says, English. I said, English. I said, what lit classes have you had? She said, well, I'm in 2 years now. I said, oh. She says, well, you're my advisor. And we have an appointment in a half hour. So, but things like that, the memory is, kind of galloping senility, just wiped it all out. But places like this, they'll come back. I think when poems happen, at least for me, is just remembering is not quite enough. We can all remember things that happened in our childhood and last week or whenever. But I think when art happens is when you, not only you have the original memory and you see it vividly in your mind, but the original emotion comes back at the same time, and you feel just like you did when you were 12 or 25 or 80 or half a year or whatever. And when that memory and the emotion rush together at the same time, then art is possible, I think. Without that, it may be a little sterile or doggerel or plain. And it doesn't always happen that way. You know, you take what you get, and what the muse offers, you take.
When you remember like that, do you remember in pictures, or do you remember
in words? Yeah. I see the picture, and if I think on hard enough, the words will start coming in the mind. And
you're describing the picture?
Yes. I talk to myself, or the muse talks to me, which is the same thing, and you just kind of get out of the way and let it go. And some come fast, and some take forever.
Jeff, I'm curious for the reason why dedicated your poem, Rest Up, to Tim.
Rest Up to Tim? Okay. And don't let me forget, too, I want to go back and read, before I forget, dedicate a poem to Sandy and all our gorilla stories. our last stop was at Carlsbad Caverns in New Mexico, and we saw the bats come out, millions of bats, then we toured the caverns and all that. But that time, after 6 weeks or 4 weeks, we were ready to come home, right? And so you've all been in that situation. We think, well, we might as well just, as my father would say, get down the line and just drive. So we got up the next morning at early 6 o'clock, broke camp, and felt like $1 million. By noon, I felt like $1.39. But I was committed to drive all night. So by 5 o'clock, I got a Big Mac. I had a Big Mac attack and got heartburn and kept on going. And, I wish I'd had some of this beautiful tabbouleh that we've had up here. I'd much rather had that than Big Mac. And we kept driving. And at 9 o'clock at night, I knew I'd made a mistake. No place to stop, no Motel 6s or 7s or 8s or anything else. And by midnight, I was out of my mind. I was curled up in the back of the Datsun with the big ice chest, and Tim, my son, was driving. It was terrible, and I kept waking up and having visions of the car not being where it was supposed to be, and yet I couldn't get awake, and I'd say, Tim, are you awake? And I kept saying, hand me a Coke. Coke's got caffeine, you know. And he said, well, you're not driving, what do you care? He kept pushing me back. And so finally, we hit Indio, California, and it was
a rest stop. So Tim did all that driving, I don't know, 1,000 miles or whatever, and so it led to this poem. Rest stop. Trucks line up like dead insects. Very large insects, their smokestack antennae dull and blackened. Window eyes high off the ground. No sign of life there. Two wine bottles are propped delicately against the sycamore. A young man is asleep on a trailer top, hands under head, his curls asleep. Every pore asleep. The rest stop is dead and dying. The miles counted before a rest stop are agonizing miles. You bite the back of hands, stretch, try to sing, try not to be sick. You stretch your eyes wide, wider, they will break. Your mouth won't open, your butt is numb, the white lines disappear, and you fear you're off in a field or off a cliff or dreaming or awake. The rest are sleeping. The whole world is sleeping. Your brights show nothing down the narrow strip of pavement. Your dimmers eat in the road. Your foot is lost between brake and accelerator. And still you bore, rip, tear, and creep down the road into the sign, rest up. And you brake to a stop, slam out of the car, pretending stiffly that you don't have to go to the bathroom. And cold water on your face and neck and wrist, because someone said a doctor said to put cold water on the wrist to wake up. Your sleeves get wet and you curse the water and your friend who told you and the doctor. The rest stop is dead and dying. Feet stick out of windows. Gurgling sounds are heard from cars. Four nuns sit straight and stare straight ahead in a 69 Plymouth. One man sleeps on the ground, a newspaper over his face. An Irish setter examines the newspaper and snuffs gently beneath it and thinks of hiking a leg. Your body tingles all over and the skin seems to stretch away from bones. You try to walk around the rest stop and discuss making it home, but you recline your seat for just 5 minutes.
That doesn't work. It's about 27 minutes, Dave.
27? Okay. I think my watch is wrong. So. Okay, this is for Sandy. Got down in Louisiana, and we left the interstate and drove down about 75 miles, and because there's a big bass reservoir there called Toledo Bend, and they flooded 90 miles of old railroad towns and forests and graveyards and everything into this big bass lake. And it's a very famous bass lake. They have the Bassmaster Championship there quite often. And it's a little town of about 19 people, as far as I could tell, and a little dirty pump with the kind of gas pump you went like this, you know, with a thing handle, watch the gas rise and the globe, and haven't seen one of those since I was a kid. And there's a banner stretched across the old road that said, welcome to, and the name of the town was Zwolle, Z-W-O-L-L-E, Zwolle, Louisiana. Welcome to the first annual Zwolle Tamale Festival. And I knew I had to stay there. We stayed there a couple of days to see if I could get in on the Zwolle Tamale Festival. But on the way into the town, we passed a little West Type Emporium on a hill called Coon Ridge Lounge. The skies were heavy and full of rain. The pickups glinted in the late sun, their radios silent because the music in the bar played softly in the shimmering heat. Inside, they lounged against the bar, bellies bulging, their boots drying on the rail. In the corner booth, a couple from Iowa watched in shadow as the good old boys whooped and hollered and slapped each other's backs and talked of Bassin at Sammy Gill's and what the new judge could do for Chigger Itch. The rain pelted the bar in sudden explosive drops running down the windows, the shadows drawing across the ceiling from the wide-bladed fan, the smell of kudzu on the air, and the sky grew dark. And the waitress turned on the one light next to the trophy cat caught by Marcel Ledbetter, and the Iowa couple looked up at Tamale Festival, Zwolle, Louisiana. Any other? I've skipped some, obviously, some states, but that's okay. You don't have to do it. No, I didn't have any text. Well, I was in Texas a week and a half, I think, to get across there, but I didn't get it. Pardon?
Georgia.
Georgia is a place in Georgia, Stone Mountain. Right?
Got a half a dollar.
What?
Stone Mountain, half dollars. I helped.
Yeah.
You what?
Helped pay for the monument.
All right. Well, this is right up your alley. Agate shone in stream beds like eyes.
Cloud streamers tied tresses in tall trees, and voices cried deep inside the dark forest where clouds of insects rose and fell over stagnant water. Home, home. And crows cried and wheeled in high circles, sidewise glancing at the brass buckle half buried in the red dirt. And again the voices, home, home, as the sun dropped behind the western hills, and shadows blue and deep moved silently through the trees towards the hill.
Do you have anything on Washington, D.C.?
No, I sure don't. Closest I got is Chesapeake Bay. That was close. I've got a couple through Pennsylvania. This is Gettysburg. The heat on Seminary Ridge rose and glimmered in the statues. The wooden fence below was dry, the distant farmhouse a dull red in the heat. Cars wound slowly along marked battle monuments. A few walkers paused and put hands to eyes along the ridge and dreamed private dreams. Heard cannon and grapeshot whiz through the old trees. Children poked fingers into holes along the stone wall, and grandparents posed for pictures. The heat rose and sucked up asphalt. Sweat poured down backs and ran under arms, and still the cars rolled carefully into history. Park rangers stood in stiff olive uniforms, their sharp-brimmed hats hiding dark eyes. And this is south through Pennsylvania. We just stopped at a gas station, and I don't even know what town it is, and there's a poem. The corn grew and rose right to the highway, and the boy pumped gas and looked at our license plate and smiled, showing large white teeth. California? And nodded, grinning. I'd purely like to go out there. The asphalt rose in smelly mounds in the heat. Perspiration ran down my neck as I watched the corn waiting for a breeze. There was no movement save the gas gauge. There were no sounds but our breathing. There was no motion save the heat ripples off the pavement. Our car swung into the highway, and he stood there with his foot on a bumper, looking at another's license. I think I'll close with this poem. It's called This Poor at Home, because after a while you do start thinking of, is my grass dying? Have my fish in my pond died? Is the dog skinny? All of which were true when I got there. This is called This Port of Home. Cars hushed at night along the bank of some strange and twisting river. Lights spring up above trees from towns where all night drugstores and laundromats are bright and empty. Tumbleweeds kick down streets blown by hot, sweet winds that carry your voice away home. And night pushes up stars whose fires burn in a darker sky than a home sky. And hills blot out great portions of memory as you fly, fly home. And morning finds you always arriving, arriving like some new ship off Spice Coast with new timbers and flowers floating seaward and garlands flung catching the new sun. This bright star, this port of home. Thank you.